We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good evening.
And good morning to everyone listening. Because we kind of end up re-airing the show in three different time slots, so that actually works. So
yes.
Yes, and because there are recordings also on our website, kodxseattle.org, people can tune in and listen at any time.
Exactly.
That's the magic of podcasting.
Mm-hmm. And the series of tubes, interconnecting tubes. So, Bruce Harrell had his State of the City address this week.
Yes, our new mayor. He gave his State of the City speech, and I'm just going to summarize some of what he said, at least some of the substance of what he said. So first off, he said that he believes in going back to the basics, which he defined as fixing potholes, enforcing criminal laws, making sure sidewalks are safe for children and families, which kind of made me scratch my head. I'm like, they're not safe now.
Yeah,
I find them to be extremely safe.
By getting rid of the homeless children and families.
Yeah, exactly. And and he mentioned his Housing First policy, which he really has yet to define. He also took credit for diversion programs that have been in place for years. But then he said that he wants to work closely with City Attorney Ann Davison, who is not emphasizing diversion programs. She's actually focusing on charging people for misdemeanors, not on increasing support for diversion programs. So that shows you where he's coming from. He said that he wants to hire more police officers, and then didn't really talk about what new policies he's putting in place to increase hiring of police officers. Instead, he asked everyone listening to his speech to apply for the job.
Yeah.
That was his main initiative.
We're passing that along as a public service to all the listeners.
Yeah, we think our listeners would maybe make better police officers than some of the folks who have applied in the past. So
no question.
Yeah. His new job program.
Now, in the meantime, Harrell said that his administration will be the one that ends the consent decree with the Department of Justice over police accountability. But he didn't say that he
not how counting he on it.
What's that?
Not counting on it.
Yeah, he didn't say how he would accomplish that actually, or give any update on the status of negotiations with the Seattle Police Officers Guild, which is the one thing that the mayor's office has some control over.
Actually, there's two things. He also needs to find a permanent police chief.
Yes, that is true. And right now, you know, I mean, it's only been about 6 weeks in his administration, but we haven't heard anything from him on that either. So he went on to say that his main work on homelessness so far has been to consolidate data collection efforts within the city government, primarily so that neighborhood NIMBYs all have a place where they can complain about icky homeless people. It's essentially the gist of what he said.
You know, I have a hard time hearing him talk about data-driven policies at this point without projectile vomiting. I mean, seriously.
Yeah. I mean, no, he basically boiled it down to, there were six different departments gathering six different types of data. Now it's all consolidated into one. So now people can call and have one number where they can complain. Essentially, that's what he said. Now, as part of this data consolidation project, he's setting up a new team, which he calls the Unified Care Team, which doesn't really have data in the name, so I'm not sure why it's got that name other than that it's a propaganda thing. But that team's going to collect data and present it to the public all in one place. So that's the name of his new team. He didn't say if his propaganda minister, Tim Burgess, would be running the team, but my guess is Tim Burgess is going to have a hand in that.
So what exactly does caring for people have to do with data? I'm not following the connection at all.
That's a good question, a very good question, for which there is no answer.
No, I know. It's just, it's kind of one of those Zen questions, right? It's a cone.
And then Harold went on in his speech to brag about how he's ramping up homeless encampment sweeps at Green Lake, Ballard Commons, and other areas. And then he said that next up is a sweep of Woodland Park. And I just want to point out that all of these places are in North Seattle. Okay. None of them are south of the Ship Canal. He did mention Broadview, which is south of the Ship Canal, but it's also very close to the wealthy neighborhoods of Capitol Hill.
They've done multiple sweeps this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these are all places where, as I said before, neighborhood NIMBYs, people who have a lot of money, don't like looking at people who have nothing. So that's something that he's jumped on and is championing. Now, he also stated the obvious about the upcoming 2023 budget, that there won't be federal COVID-19 dollars to fill about $150 million hole in the budget. And that's kind of a duh moment. It's like, okay, yeah, state the obvious for us all. But he didn't go on to say that hopefully the COVID-19 pandemic will lessen and there won't be the need for much of that $150 million. He didn't state that other obvious flip side of the coin. Okay. Yeah, so I think it's important to mention.
And as you know, people and the economy try to move on and pretend the pandemic is over, even though it isn't. You know, I think there's a lot of people who have been permanently harmed economically by a pandemic over the past couple of years.
Or they've been set back so much that it's going to take them many years to get back to where they were before the gap pandemic.
The gap between the haves and the have-nots is continuing to widen, which rhymes with Biden, coincidentally enough.
Well, okay, so Harrell also in his speech went on to cast a covetous eye on the $31 million windfall from higher than expected jumpstart payroll tax collections so far this year. The city council, though, put restrictions around that money, but it's clear now that Harrell is going to try to pull the same tricks that Jenny Durkin did last year, when she proposed a resolution to lift those restrictions on the jumpstart payroll tax funds so that she could then spend them anywhere she wanted in the budget. It looks like Bruce Harrell is going to be trying the same thing. Now, he groused about the concrete worker strike, and he offered to host negotiations in his office, which we all know is not going to happen. between construction companies and the folks who are striking to get better wages and better benefits. Now, he bragged that the first bill he's going to be sending to the city council will be to fund tourism resources by increasing the lodging tax. And then he went on to say that, yes, that is a main request of the Downtown Business Association. So essentially he was boasting, hey, I'm delivering to my constituents there, the folks who really helped me get elected.
Okay, everybody sing, I'm a puppet.
Right, exactly. So, and then finally, just to wrap up, he mentioned the formation of a Seattle Jobs Center, okay? And that was one of his big campaign promises. But then he said he would be presenting a white paper to the city council on the new jobs center, yet he gave no other details or any timeline as to when he was going to present that white paper. So we're going to just have to wait and see when that comes up, what that job center is going to look like and what that's going to entail. And that's the gist of it. He boasted about increases to various other city programs, but those changes were all made by the city council in a prior year, okay, and involved budgetary increases and resolutions that the city council made to the mayor's proposed budget last year. So I don't really think that they're important in terms of evaluating Bruce Harrell's performance.
Yeah, my overall impression of this speech was that he really wants to party like it's 1993. Like, you know, this is the continuation of the Norm Rice regime. Because, you know, none of this is new. And none of the none of the approaches are new, and the problems that he is allegedly trying to address have been around for years, and these have been approaches that have been tried in the past by and large and failed. But we're going to go do a whole rerun for the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Is what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, the only thing he really talked about having accomplished in his first month and a half in office was more homeless encampment sweeps and consolidating data collection. Those were his two, hey, these are my accomplishments kind of moments. And the rest of it was just reiterating the same sort of campaign promises that he made when he was running. And as Jav, as you've just said, there's nothing new there, really.
Yeah, although to be fair, you know, he has to do a tremendous number of hires to ramp up his administration. And he got a good start in terms of senior aides that are, you know, experienced and have been around the block, et cetera. But there's also not a lot of new ideas there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first 6 weeks of a brand new administration, I wouldn't expect a lot. But yeah, it was very, very short on substantive details.
But it is pointing out, you know, hit the direction he's moving in, and it's not a promising one. So Council President Deborah Juarez, one of the things Bruce Harrell did in his speech is he praised all of the council members that he could, which is a great way to try to build bridges. However, I don't know if he actually was sincere about a lot of it. Council President Deborah Juarez did take him at face value, and her email this week to people who subscribe to her email feed basically supported the mayor's speech 100%. And her email also gives a summary of the emails she's received from Seattleites this week. And in that, and I just wanted to kind of mention this quickly, she received 604 emails asking her to extend the Cafe Streets program, which is a resolution that will be coming up before the full council here. It went through the Transportation Committee. And she also received 115 emails asking her to vote yes on Shama Sawant's resolution to extend the eviction moratorium through the end of the COVID emergency. Essentially, if the council passes that resolution, which is also going to be coming up this week before the full council, it would extend the eviction moratorium until the city council votes to repeal it. So that's something that's coming up this week. And also coming up this week on Tuesday, the 22nd, the Public Safety and Human Services, the Public Safety and Human Services Committee will meet and hear a presentation from the council's central staff on the Seattle Police Department's year-end staffing report and their year-end crime report. So that's something to check in on if you like listening to city council meetings, or if you like reading through presentations to the city council. Those are things to keep an eye out for this coming week, because it'll be interesting. The mayor has been talking about how, well, crime is really high now in the city of Seattle. It'll be interesting to see the SPD's year-end crime report and hear the details that the central staff have been able to get from the Seattle Police Department on what is actually in and behind those statistics, and also to get some more details on the SPD's staffing for last year, you know, because they're continually complaining about how we don't have enough officers. Oh, it's really starting to impact our ability to respond to 911 calls. You know, it'll be good to see what the central staff has dug into and found about the SPD's real staffing levels, and what that's done in terms of performance. And also interesting, it'll be interesting to hear what our city council, the questions that our city council members ask, particularly Lisa Herbold, who's chair of that committee, and Andrew Lewis, who is her vice chair.
Big week in the state legislature, and a lot of people disappointed that their bills didn't get through.
Yeah, and Tuesday was the cutoff for bills to make it out of their house of origin. And there were some major bills that didn't make it. But there are some additional housing-related bills that did make it, and I want to talk a little bit about those. But first, I'm going to mention the next deadline in the state legislature is this coming Thursday, February 24th. That's going to be the last day for bills to pass out of committee in the opposite house from where they originated and be headed for the floor. With the exception of budget bills and the big transportation bill, those bills have an additional 4 days. Now, I'm just going to go over some of the bills that passed this week, adding them to the list of bills that I talked about last week. House Bill 1770 would require new buildings to be net zero ready by December 1st, 2034, 12 years from now. And it would require that the State Building Code Council develop and adopt a statewide code that includes a net 70% reduction in building emissions. And I believe that's based on 2005 or 2006 levels. House Bill 2010 would remove some restrictions on how money in the state's homeless assistance and housing surcharge fund is spent. For example, right now, there's a requirement that at least 45% of the funds not spent for administering the fund must be spent on private rental housing payments. Removing that restriction would free up more money for homeless shelters and services and allow more funding to be used for public housing versus private housing. House Bill 1175 would provide a property tax exemption for houses used as host homes for foster children. So that would hopefully encourage more people to take in foster kids and keep them from being kicked out of institutions and onto the street. House Bill 1643 would exempt from the real estate excise tax and property any property that is sold to a nonprofit or government entity to be used for affordable housing for low-income people. So that would be a great one to pass too. An incentive for property owners to sell their property to any entity that would develop it for low-income housing. Now, House Bill 1841 would allow counties to provide a county property tax exemption for accessory dwelling units, mother-in-law apartments that are rented to low-income households. Another great move that would encourage people to provide more low-income housing. House Bill 1660 would require cities and counties to allow the construction of accessory dwelling units within urban growth areas when they do their next growth management plan update. It would also prohibit homeowners and condo owners associations from banning accessory dwelling units within an urban growth area. Okay, that's another great bill. House Bill 1724 would establish an advisory committee on permanent supportive housing inside the State Department of Commerce, and it adds a new member to the Affordable Housing Advisory Board who is an operator of permanent supportive housing and services, kind of acknowledging that just emergency shelter is not enough and just market rate housing is not enough, that we must expand our options, that there has to be transitional housing that gets people stabilized and on their feet, and that provides housing for folks who permanent supportive housing really provides housing for folks who will never be able to live in market rate housing. Okay. It's an acknowledgement that there are some folks who will always need support and always need support services and will probably always be low income. That's just acknowledging reality and providing places for folks to go so that they're not either in market rate housing or living on the street. Okay. Now, House Bill 1738 would increase the debt cap for the Housing Finance Commission from $8 billion to $14 billion, again, allowing for this agency to borrow more money or issue bonds or the state to issue bonds for the construction of affordable housing. House Bill 1818 would allow the Department of Corrections to provide additional services to formerly incarcerated people to keep them from falling into homelessness. And that includes things like extending rental vouchers from 3 months to 6 months, expanding the folks who can receive those vouchers, and repealing fees related to Department of Corrections supervision, which can be a big financial burden on people who are newly released from custody. House Bill 1827 would create a new fund in the state's Commerce Department called the Community Reinvestment Account. And the funds in that account would be spent on addressing wealth disparities, like encouraging home ownership for low-income people, providing support services for formerly incarcerated folks, and community violence intervention and prevention. Okay. It could also be used to help small businesses that need loans, grants, and financial literacy training, because there are a lot of folks who have a great idea or they have a great service they could provide. They're single entrepreneurs, but they have no financial background or training in how to get the capital they need to get their business up and running or keep their business running. And this fund would do that. House Bill 1866 would establish a new fund, the Apple Health and Homes Program, to provide permanent supportive housing to folks who face barriers staying in their homes because of their health or medical situation. That's an awesome idea. So that's a really good bill to support. And then we're looking at the Senate bills. There are three Senate bills that passed this week that would help with housing and homelessness. Senate Bill 5758 would require the Housing Finance Commission to start a program to help finance the conversion of rented condos into owned homes for lower-income families. Senate Bill 5818 would lift some requirements of an environmental impact statement on certain projects that qualify as affordable housing. Senate Bill 5825 would require the State Department of Commerce to set up a work group to evaluate the feasibility of creating a statewide rental and vacant property registration program and database. That's a very, very good idea. I know this has been an issue for housing activists for decades, that many places, including the city of Seattle, have laws on their books to prevent landlords from letting their buildings become vacant and abandoned, but those and to prevent them from just sitting without being turned into useful housing or useful retail properties. And a lot of cities don't enforce those laws. This is the state basically saying, hey, you know, we should have at least a property registration system and a database of properties that are vacant around the state. And that would allow the state to track, okay, what is the status of those properties? Can we move them along and get them productive and turn them into affordable housing? I think that's an excellent idea. Now, some of the bills that I talked about last week that are advancing in the opposite house from where they originated include these three bills. House Bill 2061, which would add permanently affordable housing to the list of projects that can be funded using community revitalization funds. That bill passed the Senate Committee on Housing and Local Government on Thursday and is headed for the Senate floor. So it looks like it's got a good chance of passing. Also, House Bill 1099, which would add the goal of climate change mitigation to the goals listed in the state's Growth Management Act, and it would require local governments to revise their growth management plans to include steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, among other things. This bill passed the Senate Housing and Local Government Committee and was sent to the Ways and Means Committee to gauge its financial impact of the bill on the state's budget. So that one is also moving along, and the Democrats are very serious about passing it this year. House Bill 1735, also a bill that would roll back some of the police accountability gains made last year. Unfortunately, that bill is also moving forward. It passed the Senate Law and Justice Committee on Thursday and is headed for the Senate floor. So unless it dies on the Senate floor or is voted down, but if some Senate Democrats join the if some of the Senate Democrats who are also voting with the Republicans to pass that bill pull back and decide to vote against it, I think that bill is going to pass. Again, that bill is the one that would expand police officers' ability to use physical force in the following situations: to take a mentally ill person into custody and transport them, to take a juvenile into protective custody, when arresting a person to enforce a court order, and when executing a search warrant or when under order by a judge or judicial officer to use force. In addition, that bill would allow police officers to get around the requirement to de-escalate if de-escalation of a confrontation would restrict their ability to, quote, perform life-saving measures or perform community caretaking functions to protect health and safety, a very vague circumstance, and that it doesn't, quote, prevent a peace officer from responding to requests for assistance or service by specified individuals and members of the public. Again, it would allow a police officer to avoid de-escalation if anyone called them and said, hey, there's some guy running around naked outside my house or something. Some very vague terms there that would allow exceptions to the laws that were passed last year. So that's bad news. And folks should be contacting your representatives and asking them, particularly your Senate representatives, and asking them to vote against that bill.
Yeah, that's serious backsliding.
Mm-hmm. So those are the housing-related bills that that passed before the cutoff this week. And if you are interested in tracking any bills or looking at the other bills that are being passed by the legislature this year, just go to leg.wa.gov and you can click on the bill lookup, or and you can look up bills by their subject matter, which I think is a great way to find bills that you're interested in.
Yeah, it's a very user-friendly system.
Mm-hmm. And also in the state legislature this week, the Democrats rolled out their transportation package. Last year, they passed their big budget package. This year, it's tackling the transportation bill. The proposal that they've made is a $16.8 billion bill, and it would cover spending on projects over 16 years. Of that $16.8 billion, $4 billion would go for highway projects, including $2.6 billion for new highway projects, plus $1.4 billion to finish up highway projects that were started under previous bills. And there would be, in addition, there would be another $3 billion for highway maintenance. So approximately 42% of the total package is going to go for highway construction and maintenance, okay?
That's a lot of pavement.
But this is, and a lot of us would consider that as not a good thing. But I think this is probably the very first bill, in my experience, proposed in the state legislature in which less than 50% is for highway construction and maintenance. So it is moving in the right direction, if not maybe as quickly as we would hope.
Remember like 10 years ago when the state legislature was split between Democrats and Republicans, and they literally couldn't even agree on a transportation budget for years?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's better than that.
Yeah, and I remember previous transportation proposals where, you know, 80 to 90% of the package was focused on highway projects.
Yep.
So it is a big stride, better than that. Now, also in the package is $3 billion for new transit projects. Also, $1.4 billion for grants to local transit agencies. So if you take those two together, that's about 26% of the bill, a good one quarter of the bill for transit projects, for local transit projects, I want to say. $2.5 billion of the bill will remove barriers to fish passage. Remember, that was like right at the top of my list of priorities, that the state start working on that and getting our transportation infrastructure to mesh with our environmental goals, particularly the restoration of salmon and steelhead species in the state of Washington. This package also includes $1.2 billion for bike and pedestrian paths. So a significant chunk this year for multimodal transportation that doesn't rely on highways necessarily. And then it also includes another small – there are a lot of other small things, but One nice chunk in there is $150 million for an ultra high speed rail line from Vancouver, BC to Portland, Oregon, which would help to secure about $700 million in federal matching funds. That would just be a down payment, probably to study and to work on the design of a regional interstate rail system, high speed rail system. So that's really positive and a good piece of news. But one thing the package doesn't include is any money for Sound Transit. So regional light rail is not going to get any funds out of this package at all.
Was Sound Transit expecting any?
Well, I think a lot of people were looking at the struggle Sound Transit is having to fund Sound Transit 3. And they were hoping that the state would throw some money in there, and the Democrats just didn't do it this time. I think they're thinking that Sound Transit is going to have to fend for itself and ask for special appropriations directly from the state. But I think the attitude in the state legislature has been in the past and is going to continue to be, well, that's something the Tri-County area of King, Pierce, and Snohomish is going to have to fund themselves. You guys are on your own. You're going to have to kick in money there and apply to the federal government for matching funds for any expansion of Sound Transit. That's not really something that a lot of state representatives, particularly representatives from east of the Cascades, but also north and south of the Tri-County area, just don't care about. So the transportation bill is going to be funded. This transportation bill is going to be funded from revenue that includes things like $5 billion from the state's new greenhouse gas cap and trade program, which the state is working on implementing. $3.4 billion in one-time federal money from the American Rescue Plan Act. That's the infrastructure bill that was passed in Congress last year. $2 billion from a new 6 cent per gallon tax on fuel that's exported from Washington State. $2 billion in one-time transfers from the state's general fund into the state's transportation fund. $1.4 billion from increase in license and car tab fees. And $1 billion in new bonds, essentially the state borrowing to cover the transportation bill. And one thing that won't be in it, which has been in prior transportation packages, is an increase in the gas tax. So that's my wrap up of what's in the transportation bill. We'll see if the Democrats can all agree. I know in prior years, Steve Hobbs, who was the chair of the Transportation Committee in the Senate, was a very conservative Democrat who I think in previous generations would have been considered a mainstream Republican. He often objected to big spending plans like this, but he's no longer the chair of the Transportation Committee. It's Mark Elias now, and Mark Elias is working hard in the Senate to get this bill passed. So we'll see if the Democrats can get it passed, or if any of the sort of conservative Democrats put a wrench in the works and stop it.
Okay. Moving on, King County Council repealing bike helmets this week?
Yeah, that was kind of a counterintuitive headline that surprised a lot of people, I think. The King County Council voted to repeal the bike helmet law, and I want to talk a couple minutes about that because the ostensible reason for repealing it is not really the same as the actual reason for repealing it, as is often the case with legislation. What the county council said was, well, this is being disproportionately enforced. It's hurting poor people. It's hurting people of color. Well, yeah, but if that's actually the problem, you could do what the city of Seattle did a few weeks ago and just tell police not to ticket people for it or not to pull people over for that violation. But they went ahead and repealed the entire law, which is kind of like saying, okay, so last year we see in these our data-driven statistics that, more people of color committed murder disproportionate to their population, so we're going to legalize murder. It just makes no sense, right?
I had the same response of just leave it on the books, but change your enforcement. Right.
Yeah.
And work harder to make police accountable for not pulling over more people disproportionately because of the color of their skin.
Yeah, and maybe the message there is, well, we know the cops are racist and we can't do anything about it, so let's change the laws to accommodate it. But that's not actually why they passed it. You look at who was lobbying for passage of this particular bill, and it turns out to be bike share companies, because they're trying to avoid liability for the fact that they cannot ensure that people who purchase their services and basically rent bikes are wearing helmets.
Yeah, and it's expensive to provide those at the same time that you provide the bike.
Oh, heaven forbid. Yeah. So, yeah. So that actually is who wanted this to pass. And it is, I mean, the public messaging on this is terrible because, you know, you want to encourage people to wear bike helmets, right? They really do save lives. I know a couple people personally, personal friends who were involved in serious bicycle accidents with vehicles, one of whom had permanent brain damage, and they'd probably both be dead if they were not wearing bike helmets. It really does save lives, and it really is a public health message. But of course, as we'll talk about in the pandemic in a minute, public policy is not necessarily driven by public health considerations, and this is another example of that. So yeah, it comes down to trying to do a favor to an influential sector of the economy, and it's not really doing very much for either communities of color or poor people or overall bicycle safety. But yeah, that's really where it was coming from, and it doesn't have to do a whole lot with trying to protect, say, homeless people from getting ticketed. And it is true that the laws were being enforced disproportionately. That was a legitimate problem, but it was not the reason the county council took this action.
Wow. Moving on then to this week's pandemic developments.
Yeah, well, we certainly had some news this week. Locally, King County announced on Wednesday that as of March 1st, which is actually coming up in a little over a week, vaccination status won't be checked in restaurants, bars, theaters, and gyms. And, you know, there are still some restrictions wearing masks indoors, for example. However, on the 21st of March, Jay Inslee announced on Thursday that masks will not be required in restaurants, bars, schools, childcare facilities, gyms, houses of worship, or grocery stores. So, you know, if you are under 5 and not eligible to be vaccinated, or if you are immunocompromised or immunosuppressed, or if you just haven't been vaccinated, you're on your own. We do see falling infection numbers in terms of new cases and hospitalizations in the state. The death rate is still rather high, which mirrors national trends, but that's also a lagging indicator. It'll take some time for that to come down from all the cases of Omicron. Omicron, incidentally, has killed far more people in the U.S. than Delta, the previous variant wave. And that even though it is overall milder for a lot of people, it infected so many more people because it's so transmissible that the overall death toll has been quite a bit higher. It's still 1,500 or so a day nationally, which is a 9/11 every couple of days, and we are closing in on 1 million deaths in the United States from COVID-19 over the past 2 years. We are also we're a little over 2 years past the first death from COVID, which was, of course, on the east side in Washington State. The east side, I mean, of Seattle Metro, the nursing home in Kirkland. But, we're seeing this kind of trend in a lot of cases. California did an interesting thing this week. They rolled out what they said was their plan for dealing with COVID-19 as an endemic rather than pandemic problem. In other words, they're anticipating that we're going to continue to have COVID-19 among us, and how do we manage it? And this was an attempt to
craft public policy to address that question. So they're talking about measures, for example, to promote vaccines, to stockpile medical supplies, and to mount an aggressive assault on disinformation. And that is a, that's a direct quote. So I don't know that that in itself will be adequate. We are, you know, certainly susceptible to additional variants in the future. And the history of this pandemic over the past 2 years has been, literally from the first weeks of the pandemic. We saw this with the Trump administration and Republican governors where, we were really want to push to open things up and get back to normal and get the economy going. Well, the economy is going great now. And, we are seeing a lot of democratically led states now, Democrat party-led states now, where they are repealing various mandates and allowing things to get back to normal, quote-unquote. But it's not back to normal for everyone. You're going to continue to see infections because we're nowhere near herd immunity yet, and we probably may never be. The question is, how do you deal with this as an ongoing problem? But it's also, is this too soon? And the CDC has been saying it's too soon. President Biden came out last week and said it's too soon. But this is not slowing states down. They're looking at where the trends are going, and they're looking not just at public health considerations, but also business considerations. And the business considerations are winning right now. And the people who are refusing to comply with pandemic mandates are winning right now. And that's very unfortunate, because it just prolongs the misery and leads to more death, unfortunately. Speaking of additional possible variants, we have a subvariant. Omicron is known in scientific terms as BA.1. We now have a BA.2 that has become the dominant variant, or in this case, subvariant, in at least 10 countries. China, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, the Philippines, Denmark, and South Africa. And the preliminary results, we're getting mixed signals on whether it's more virulent than the original Omicron, but it does seem to be even more transmissible, which is kind of insane given how transmissible the original variant Omicron was. This was first identified in Denmark and South Africa. Of course, South Africa was also one of the original countries for the original Omicron variant. And it's nearly 100% of infections in South Africa right now. The good news is that the overall number of new cases is down markedly in South Africa. So it seems to be supplanting the original Omicron, but not as many cases. So hopefully this is the kind of development that we saw in the Spanish Civil War, the Spanish flu, where how the pandemic died out after a couple of years at the end of World War One is that a new variant came up that was milder than the original variant that supplanted the original virus that caused Spanish flu, and eventually just died out. Hopefully that's the direction we're going in. We don't know that yet. And this is probably not the last variation on SARS-CoV-2 that we're going to see over the next year or so. So as we move into warmer weather, hopefully that will help also. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. But it does seem to be premature to have all the opening up that we're seeing in a lot of different states. And at least in Washington state, you know, those restrictions are not going to be lifted until March 21st. So the weather will start to warm up by then, and that'll help. We'll see. We'll see how it goes over the next few weeks. We'll keep an eye on it.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on to national news and police-related issues.
Yeah, police and court. We had a couple of different mass indictments of police officers this week, and neither of them has gotten a lot of attention. The East Los Angeles station of the California Highway Patrol had 54 officers indicted, including supervisors. They were charged with fraud for overstating the number of overtime hours that they had worked. And it took them years to uncover this because the supervisors weren't on the scheme. They were charging and getting paid for hours that they never worked for things like, directing traffic around accident scenes or, that kind of stuff. This is reminiscent of some of the lack of accountability for overtime hours within SPD as well. So it would sure be nice to see that that kind of prosecution locally. The case was actually brought by the state attorney general in California and not by a local entity, which was interesting. The other indictment was by a grand jury in Austin, Texas, of 21 Austin police officers for using excessive force during the 2020 summer protests after the murder of George Floyd. And this, again, is something that we haven't seen in a lot of other cities, and we could certainly see that here. It certainly applies to SPD as well, and the voluminous number of excessive force complaints that have already been lodged with oversight bodies and, by and large, gone nowhere, and the number of civil suits that have been launched as well in response to that. And then finally, yesterday, Kim Potter, the officer in Minnesota that shot and killed young Dante Wright and claimed that she thought she was reaching for her taser and instead reached for her service weapon. And then she had been convicted a couple months back. She was sentenced yesterday to 16 months once you subtract for good behavior and time served. 16 months she will serve for killing that young black man. A lot of people in Minnesota are very upset about this and nationally as well. So that's that headline. And then there were a few other notable court decisions this week too. Families of the victims of the Sandy Hook shooting back in, I believe it was 2013, settled with the gun maker Remington for $73 million for Remington's liability under Connecticut law for the weapon that was used in those shootings. Now, Congress has generally, exempted gun manufacturers from this kind of civil suit. But Connecticut law is written in such a way that it opened the door for this kind of a suit. And it was an encouraging sign to see gun makers, even though Remington itself went into receivership a couple of years ago. The receivership is still liable for that money. And combining this with the money that Sandy Hook families won from Alex Jones a couple months ago for his, repeatedly, spreading the conspiracy theory that, Sandy Hook, was a massive fraud, designed to discredit gun owners, that it, they were all paid actors, et cetera, et cetera. They've won a couple of major lawsuits in the last couple of months, and that's very encouraging to see. We also saw Sarah Palin lose in court early this week. She had sued the New York Times for defaming her, which is really kind of difficult to do if you're suing Sarah Palin. She's her own worst enemy in terms of her public perception. But the judge in the case had said on, I believe it was Tuesday, that no matter what the jury decided, that he was going to throw out the lawsuit. And, the jury came back the following day throwing out the lawsuit, so the judge didn't have to overrule them. But it really shows how superfluous many of these lawsuits on the far right are and how they're designed really more for public consumption on Fox and Friends than they are for any kind of redressing any actual wrong in here on Earth One. And then finally, a woman named Virginia Siufri, who had sued Prince Andrew for being a victim of Jeffrey Epstein's underage sex ring. And she claimed that Prince Andrew had raped her when she was underage. And Prince Andrew settled with her this week, which was some degree of justice for her. And, of course, it probably, as much as anything, reflects the desire of the British royal family to try and keep this out of the headlines as much as possible. So she got some justice, and goodness knows the royal family has a lot of money, so they can afford to pay out. That was this week in the courts. We should also mention that Donald Trump keeps getting his lawsuits thrown out or overturned. He's had a number of court setbacks in recent weeks, including this week, and we also keep hearing that the story of the classified documents that he took with him from the White House to Mauritania for Mar-a-Lago. It just keeps getting worse and worse. The National Archives sent a letter to the House of Representatives yesterday in which they basically spelled out all the ways that, you know, they're going through 15 boxes which they say contained sensitive top secret information. This shouldn't surprise anybody. Remember that one of the first ways that Donald Trump made headlines in 2017 was that he was using his own personal unsecured cell phone for diplomatic calls, and that the Chinese, among other countries, were probably listening into all of his calls. He's never cared about security. He's always cared about his own convenience. And, of course, in this case, the delusion that he should still be president.
What I find kind of interesting about all this is he kept saying that Hillary Clinton should be prosecuted for having her own email server in her home. And here he is walking out of the White House with 15 boxes full of documents that should have been sent to the National Archives instead. And now we find out that they contained classified documents in there as well. So.
Yep. Lock them up.
Yeah, exactly. So, but also this week too, Trump was fired by his accounting firm, Mazars USA.
Oh yeah, we should talk about that. Yes.
Oh yeah, that firm also withdrew. They didn't just fire him, so it wasn't something like, well, you know, he's late paying his bills or whatever he does, or he disputed a bill with us and we're just letting him go because he's a bad client. No.
Yeah, they disavowed 10 years worth of tax.
They said, you know, we're withdrawing all. Of the financial statement work that we did, all of the financial statements that we prepared for his business, the Trump Organization, from 2011 to 2020. And they went further. They instructed him to notify all of the folks that he provided those financial statements to that those statements are no longer acceptable. And that includes any banks that issued loans based on those statements.
And remember, he has a number of loans coming due in the next year or two already. And this encourages banks who don't necessarily have that money coming due to call the loan in because it was based on basically fraudulent information.
Or not roll it over. Now, those financial statements are really key to two investigations that are in the works right now by the New York Attorney General Letitia James and the Manhattan District Attorney. They're investigating charges that the Trump Organization committed bank fraud by lying about the value of its assets and possibly also tax fraud by misrepresenting the value of their assets to the New York Department of Revenue, okay, and the City of New York. So the judge in the New York Attorney General's civil investigation ruled this week on Thursday that Letitia James can now question Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump under oath in that investigation. Judge Arthur Engoron ordered the Trumps to appear for questioning within the next 3 weeks and to provide documents that were subpoenaed by Attorney General Letitia James. Also this week, as you said, Job, the National Archives confirmed that some of the documents that Donald Trump took home were classified. So he's in big legal trouble right now. The Attorney General, Letitia James, has said that she has lots of documentation that shows that the Trump Organization committed bank fraud. And anything that she is able to unearth then be in her civil investigation then becomes fodder that can be used by the Manhattan District Attorney in their criminal investigation.
Yeah. So he could, and the Trump Organization has already been indicted.
Yeah. So he could go to prison. Essentially.
Yeah. It can't.
It may take some time.
Honestly.
Yeah. It may take some time, but, it's looking very bad for him.
And going down memory lane, you know who is responsible for all of this, kicking all of this off? Michael Cohen's testimony to Congress in 2018. He was talking about that valuation issue, and that looks like that is a serious legal problem for Donald Trump right now.
Yeah, but you know, there wouldn't be this if Trump didn't have the attitude that he can game the system and it's all just, you know, how you represent yourself. You know, nothing you say has to be based in reality or the truth.
Yep. Well, you know, Al Capone was brought down by taxes.
Yeah.
Just saying.
He was imprisoned for tax fraud.
Yep.
So we'll see.
All right. Okay.
So that's our upbeat story for the week.
Gotta have one.
Yep.
Put it in there to offset the rest.
Yes.
All right. Well.
So, can we move overseas? We got, what, 3 minutes left or something?
We have maybe a minute to 2 minutes.
Okay.
So, go for it.
All right. Well, again, we've run out of time to talk about Ukraine, but there's some interesting gamesmanship going on. Putin has not painted himself into a corner at all. He's a much too good a chess player for that. But you're hearing that a lot from various hot takes in U.S. media, which is missing an essential fact, which is that the story being fed the domestic public in Russia is very, very different than the international perception. And that, you know, the United States intelligence community doesn't necessarily have a lot of credibility either. So it may or may not be true that there's 190,000 Russian troops surrounding Ukraine right now, ready to invade. But there's a lot of gamesmanship going on. And, you know, Putin could easily back down and then say the U.S. Intelligence people have no credibility. They were wrong all along. So he's in a win-win situation, really. Biden came right out yesterday and said, we fully expect a land invasion of Ukraine. They're going to target the capital of Kiev, which I've been to. It's a lovely city. The question is, what's Putin's end goal here? His end goal, ostensibly is to split the West and weaken NATO. And this has done the opposite so far. A lot of different ways this could still play out. And then I wanted to mention briefly, the Canadian protests are winding down. Police early in the week broke up the blockade of the Ambassador Bridge in Windsor, the blockade at the border between Montana and Alberta. That came to an end. And then over the last couple of days, there have been these literally street battles in front of the Canadian Parliament in the capital of Ottawa, ending the 3-week siege of downtown there, which people have been very critical of police for not moving more quickly against that protest. And people on the right are howling foul as though, you know, the way police treat protesters, which they cheered on when it happened in 2020, in Canada they cheer on when Indigenous people block pipelines. They're horrified now that they're trying to overthrow a democratically elected government, and they're being treated the same way. So there have been hundreds of arrests, including of some of the protest leaders, and that appears to be wrapping up this morning. So that's the update.